So I want to welcome all of the participants to today's Compact for Racial Justice Forum call on race and health. My name is Jill Reese. I am the Health Equity Program Director for the Northwest Federation of Community Organizations, also known as NIFCO. Again, want to welcome everyone who's joined the phone call today. Around 225 people signed up for this call, so that's really exciting, and I'm glad so many folks have decided to join us. I want to start off with just a couple of housekeeping notes. So just want to inform everyone, if you haven't already heard, this call is being recorded for ARC's use and for the use of other media outlets. And ARC will be posting a recording of this and future calls onto the website after we're done with the call. And also, we're asking participants, if you have any questions, to direct your questions to us via email. Send your name, your organizational affiliation, and the question to compact, C-O-M-P-A-C-T, at arc.org. And I want to say I anticipate there will be a large number of questions, and there's no way we're going to get to all of them, so I'm going to just apologize in advance if yours doesn't get answered. So I want to start off by saying just a word about our organizations. The Applied Research Center is a racial justice think tank that bridges policy research, media advocacy, and community activism. ARC is hosting this series of compact forum calls to create a space to share ideas about how to apply a racial equity framework to all of the policy proposals that are coming out of D.C. and state capitals, proposals that will have major implications for people of color and for racial equity. NIFCO, the group that I work for, is a regional organization based in Seattle. We've been doing work to address health equity for many years. About 10 years ago, we applied the Fair Housing Testing Model to SCHIP to identify barriers to access for people of color. We also co-authored a report with ARC called Closing the Gap, and that's examining racial disparities. And we do support for local organizations on campaigns to address racial and health justice in their communities. And in addition to that, we work with a network of grassroots organizations across the country that are working on housing, nutrition, transportation, healthcare reform, et cetera. Most of our experience is around working with hospitals and a set of practices that address institutional racism. And, you know, we hope to be one of many voices that are working to address this really critical issue. So I want to say, when we're talking about health equity and race and health, we're not just talking about healthcare and the healthcare system. We're also talking about social determinants of health, such as food, housing, transportation, jobs, et cetera. So really, where we live, work, play, all those things inform our health. And when we do focus on healthcare, we think it's important to look beyond health insurance, which is often how that debate is framed, and to address equity and quality of care as well. So we know all of these things lead to huge racially disparate outcomes in the health of people in our communities. So this call is happening at a propitious moment for making advances in health equity. We're right on the heels of an economic stimulus bill that included money that will actually address disparities, and we're on the brink of a national debate on health care reform. So just a quick word about stimulus. There was money in the bill. That there's money for data collection on race and ethnicity. There's money to increase providers in communities. There's money for community clinics, Indian health services, and prevention and wellness. And I just want to say I think there's still a lot of work to be done on stimulus. So it's passed. There's a lot of good stuff there, but we have to be really engaged at the local level to see how it's shaped at the local level, where the money's going, who are the contractors, et cetera. So I just want to kind of put that plug in. And I think we also have to be watching for a round two. It doesn't look like the economy is getting better as folks hoped. So that's something important to watch. Another key battle that we know is coming, that's coming, it's happening right now, is healthcare reform. So President Obama included over $630 billion in his budget for healthcare reform. He's convening a healthcare summit in 2 days to start work on the issue. And we see a few key battles that will impact racial justice and healthcare. One of them is around immigrant inclusion. You know, this is at risk. But we saw in SCHIP, what we saw in SCHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, which just passed with a provision that gives states the option to cover legal permanent resident children and pregnant women. What we saw was the first time that the Democrats were willing to really stand up and talk about why immigrants need health care. And so there's a lot of hope that we can have that fight. So we have we're optimistic about that. Another key battle is really around the public health insurance plan, and we know that private health insurance really perpetuates racial disparities. And programs such as CHIP, Medicaid, and Medicare do go some way towards reducing disparities. So we think that public health insurance option is really critical. Although, again, we know coverage isn't enough, it is an important thing for us to fight for. And then another thing we see coming is really specifically around health equity. We know that the Tri-Caucus is committed to addressing equity in healthcare reform and are trying to figure out ways to insert health equity in the bigger package, and we think that it may look like the health equity and accountability bill that we saw in the past. And one key piece of this is health, this thing called health empowerment zones, and it's really one potential way that we can address social determinants in health. In healthcare reform, and really that's just money from the federal government to communities of color to do private-public partnerships to reduce disparities. So it's there's a lot happening, and we want to spend some time today looking at work on the ground that's being done to address racial and health justice. So I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to introduce some other folks to talk to us about the work they're doing. I'm going to introduce everyone in the order they're going to be speaking and then just let folks say their piece. So we're going to start off with Fatima Morales. She is a community organizer with Washington Community Action Network in Seattle, Washington. Washington CAN is a statewide grassroots organization with over 30,000 members, and they work on a range of issues with the broad aim of bringing about greater social, racial, and economic justice. Leo Morales is a senior community organizer with the Idaho Community Action Network in Boise, Idaho, and ICANN is a grassroots organization with over 2,000 members statewide. They also work to address issues of social, racial, and economic justice. Javier Valdez is the deputy director of Make the Road New York, and Make the Road New York is a nonprofit membership-led organization based in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And they promote economic justice, equity, and opportunity for all New Yorkers through community and electoral organizing, strategic policy advocacy, leadership development, youth and adult education, and high-quality legal and support services. And then we'll have Jonathan Heller. He's the project director and co-founder of Human Impact Partners. HIP believes that health should be considered in all decision-making, and they raise awareness of and collaboratively use innovative data processes and tools that evaluate health impacts and inequities in order to transform the policies, institutions, and places people need to live healthy lives. After folks have spoken, we are going to do a Q&A, and I want to again say if you have a question, you can start emailing them in right away, and you just email your questions into compact@arc.org. So I'm going to turn it over now to Fatima Morales.
Okay, thank you so much, Jill, and thank you everyone who's listening on this phone call. As Jill said, I'm an organizer with Washington CAN, and we are the largest grassroots organizing agency in Washington and Seattle. And so we have members throughout the entire state, and in our work, our two issues are healthcare and immigration. As we were trying to move forward and push the for healthcare reform as well as for comprehensive immigration reform, we kept coming across stories where people didn't have access to medical staff who spoke their language. We had people who were filing for bankruptcy because they could not pay off, you know, their medical bills. We also heard a lot of stories about people not being able to access hospitals, only having access to clinics or community health centers because hospitals were not located within their communities, or it was too far of a drive, too much of a bus drive. And so hearing this from our members and people in the community, Washington CAN really decided to look critically at the current state of our healthcare system, as well as thinking about moving forward with healthcare reform, what are the, who are the communities that we need to make sure are included and whose voices are represented and who have access to care when they need it, just like everyone else. And so a lot of our work that we do here at Washington CAN has focused on eliminating language barriers for limited English speakers, as well as new immigrants to the country, eliminating financial barriers for communities of color, low-income communities, and again, immigrant communities, limited English speaking communities, and eliminating geographic barriers. And some of the ways that we work at the state and the federal level. So we try and link up our campaigns as often as possible. And sometimes there's overlap, and sometimes you kind of have to get creative with the connections. But this year, within the state, we have, and this is also a process that started last year, we've been working to pass a law in the state that would expand access to interpretation services for limited English speakers by requiring insurance companies to cover these costs for their policyholders. Meaning, right now, the way interpretation services are provided in the state of Washington, if you have Medicaid, you have some guarantee that you'll have access to an interpreter, because currently in the state, people on Medicaid or patients who are on Medicaid have access to interpreters because Medicaid will reimburse for the services. However, everyone else is left struggling to find either a child, a loved one, a family friend to interpret, or relying on medical staff who maybe that isn't really their role at the hospital, and or they're foregoing care or delaying care because going to the hospital becomes this journey to get access. And so a lot of our community members were facing barriers in getting interpretation services, or children were put in positions where they're interpreting the wrong things. We had a member who reported a story where she ingested a suppository because her child didn't know how to tell her, or maybe it was somewhat uncomfortable, actually, to say, you know, this is how you take this pill. And so we hear the demand, and we hear that we need these services. And the truth is, Washington State has had, and throughout the nation, there have been increases in our foreign-born population and multilingual populations. So this is an issue that we needed to address that was creating barriers for predominantly low-income communities of color, and was having an effect on the health outcomes of our communities, meaning that communities who didn't have access were generally more sick, weren't getting care, and this was just unacceptable. So we started working to pass a law in the state that would expand services for limited English speakers by trying to pass a law that would say insurance companies need to provide for this. Last year, it was reduced to a study, and then the funding fell out. And this year, we had a much more deliberate and organized effort to push for this bill to become a law. We had great support. We started the process for developing a coalition and a working group that's come together with state agency, interpreter groups, community members, working together to support and pass this law, as well as we did a lot of outreach and education around barriers and collecting stories from community members around, you know, barriers to care because of language. And so we've got some great first steps. Unfortunately, the bill didn't make it out of committee this year. There was a $1 million fiscal note, which in this economic climate was just not going to, it really created a barrier for our bill moving forward, and also kind of killed the bill in essence. So that's just one example of how we're working to expand or eliminate barriers to care related to language for our communities. We're building coalitions, we're getting the community involved, and we're really getting ready for this next year. So this was a step towards the future. We also, in terms of eliminating financial barriers, we did a lot of work around when the economic stimulus package was coming out, to have E-Verify taken out of the package, or any bill that was going to move forward. And the reason we did that is, one, because we do a lot of work around immigrant rights, and E-Verify would have been a nightmare. But also, you think about all the people who would lose their jobs. And when we say include everyone, we mean include everyone. So thinking about E-Verify and the impact it had on small businesses and businesses to implement this system, and also all the individuals who would then either find themselves out of work or, you know, without health care, this is a nightmare. This would shoot up it would drive up the cost for people, financial barriers for our communities, for members of our organization, and a lot of the members of our ally organization. So we really worked hard to monitor and make sure that E-Verify wasn't included at the federal level in the economic stimulus package. Similarly, we did a lot of work to put pressure on our lawmakers to make sure that the state Children's Health Insurance Partnership included head immigrant, remove the five-year waiting period for immigrant children. Again, this is a financial barrier. This prevents individuals who are in need of care from accessing care when they need it, because you know, they're a legal permanent resident instead of, and it's just a second tier of care. And so we really worked hard to make sure that children were included in the state. We have the governor has set the goal of covering all kids by 2010, and we worked really hard to say, well, if we don't have government support federally and within the state to make sure all kids are included and all kids are covered, then you're really not meeting your goal. And so great news to see that we did get funding to, and we can meet our goals in 2010. In terms of geographic barriers, today we had a report release from a report that was produced by the Northwest Federation of Community Organizations, which looked at five Seattle hospitals and the ways that they're meeting the needs of the communities they served. And the title of the report is Equal Treatment, Seattle Hospitals Put to the Test. And what the report found was that currently there are racial disparities in access to hospital care, meaning that communities south of downtown Seattle face language barriers, geographic barriers, and financial barriers to care. Hospitals in Seattle have lower, there was one hospital that, Harborview Hospital here in the state, that reported high revenues coming from Medicaid patients, as well as, you know, a lot of its funding, a good portion of its funding going to charity care, but all other hospitals failed. So today we had a really successful press conference. We had news, print media, alternate, you know, Latino media present at the event covering the news, because it echoes what everyone kind of sees or what you hear here and there, you know, one story here, one story there. But what we were really trying to do with this report and why we released it so publicly, we released it outside of Virginia Mason, which is was the lowest performing hospital included in the study, because we're serious about addressing these disparities, addressing the barriers to care that communities of color and low-income communities face when they're trying to see a doctor. And we had great support from community members and ally groups, and hospital staff was not too happy that we were there. But we had a really successful event where we're bringing, again, race to the forefront. We're saying, even though communities in the south of Seattle compared to communities to the north, which tend to be more white and affluent, and communities in the south are, you know, tend to be more low income and higher concentration of communities of color, even though the south has higher rates of asthma, higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of infant mortality, they have to travel 2.5 miles farther to reach the closest hospital. And they encounter 10-minute waiting times to have an interpreter to talk to their doctor. They aren't made aware of charity care that's available. And hospitals play a critical role in eliminating these barriers. So we hosted a press conference outside of Virginia Mason in order to highlight the barriers their communities are facing, all of our communities are facing, but also to start a dialogue, to say, this has come out, the report findings are disturbing, what are we going to do about it? This requires hospitals, lawmakers, and community groups all working together. And so some of the highlights of the type of work we're doing here with Washington CAN to put barriers that communities face, communities of color face in access to care at the forefront of our work, linking it to our state work as well as our federal work.
Thanks, Fatima. This, I just want to give our presenters another heads up that we're asking folks to do about 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure everyone gets a chance to talk, and then that we have enough time for questions. So I'm going to now have Leo from ICANN talk a little bit about pesticides.
Great. Thank you, Jill, and thank you, everyone. You know, EPA estimates that agricultural workers suffer 10 to 20,000 acute pesticide poisoning each year. And farm workers, again, are among the class of individuals that are also are more highly exposed to these very hazardous chemicals. And for us, when we look at the issue of healthcare as well, we also, of course, so in this example, we'll be talking about pesticides. There's one particular case which I'll highlight, and then I will continue on with some of the work that we did with the local hospital, and then I'll conclude with accountability campaigns that also leads to addressing the social determinants of health. So in 2005, in July, which is the hottest month in the state of Idaho, 29 farm workers were poisoned basically with three very hazardous pesticides. As a result, workers were hospitalized and received not the greatest treatment, of course. The way it started was, it was in the morning, workers arrived around 6 in the morning, which is usually the time that workers start working. They arrived around 6 in the morning, everything seems like any other day, so workers immediately entered the field. Even the crew leader did not know that that field had actually been exposed to pesticides. So they entered the field, they were working in the onions. And the way that the work is done in onions in this particular time of the season is that workers usually have a very small hoe. It's one of the tools that they use. But slowly what has been happening is that more and more crew bosses are not allowing that, and so workers have returned to using knives. They're about 10 inches, so that the fact that back can work as they bend down to where the onion is at to get rid of the bad weeds, basically. And so what happened that morning was that workers entered the fields, and of course they started getting that morning it was in the summers, of course, it's always the fields is usually wet because of the dew and the condensation. So workers started to work, and pesticides, the chemicals, because they were all liquid, basically came on their hands. And by 10 in the morning, one of the workers, one of her ICANN members, actually began to feel the symptoms, which included nauseous, dizziness, short of breath, heartbeat increased. And she went to her crew boss and basically said, "I'm not feeling well. Something must be wrong." And the boss basically said, "Well, it could be the heat, so it's, you know, take us a layer of clothing." But, of course, what had happened was that she had been exposed to pesticides, and eventually she couldn't take what was happening to her body, so one of her coworkers drove her to the hospital. Usually around 10 in the morning, workers get a lunch break, for a small 15-minute break, and that's when workers take an opportunity to eat. So on that day, not only did the workers inhale what they were working, but they also it became part of the food, and sometimes there's no drinking water or places to go wash hands. So workers also then ingested the chemicals. They moved from the onion field to a sugar beet field where they were supposed to do more work. It was around closer to noon when workers arrived in the other fields, and that's really where the workers, because of the heat, workers really started to feel the symptoms and literally started falling like flies. Emergency vehicles eventually arrived at the scene. Workers were then taken to the hospital. At the hospital, however, they weren't prepared. One is that the hospital did not have inadequate interpreters, and so what they started to do is they actually started to make the workers themselves be the interpreters. They asked some of the sick workers to begin to interpret for the other workers that did not communicate. So that was an issue. And we as an organization firmly believe that, you know, the best medicine is really communication. And in this particular situation, that communication was not made available. So the incident occurred. Again, 29 farm workers were gravely hurt by particular incidents. Two of them remained in critical care for about 2 days, and then they were finally released.
Leo?
Yes?
Hey, this is Jill. Sorry. I just wanted to let you know that you have about a minute left, so if you could talk about the solutions that you guys identified, I think that folks would be really interested in hearing about that.
Thank you. And actually, I was transitioning to that.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. Perfect timing. So, you know, so what we ended up doing is, of course, there's accountability campaigns that we have to run. So one, we work directly with the hospital. We set up some meetings with the hospital CEO. We had conversations with him. We showed the facts. We showed the fact that the hospital just had inadequate interpreters for the community in general. Eventually, there were working committees that were set up. We had several meetings throughout the summer and eventually came up with good conclusions, actually. We were able to have the hospital improve their bilingual signage. We also established scholarships to recruit more Latino worker, bilingual students and workers. Also increased the compensation for their staff. And there were many other demands that we were able to get. At the state level, of course, we knew that there was issues with how the state was not forcing the law itself. So on the day of the incident, we also held a community gathering where we brought the Department of Labor and the Department of Agriculture and had several demands for them. Among them really included to do an open process during the investigation of what had happened, to come back and report to the community, and also punish the perpetrators to the full extent of the law, and also run an extensive education campaign to the farm worker community. All demands were actually met as a result of some of the pressure that we were able to put both departments. And those are just, you know, it's a feel for some of the work that we've been able to do to be able to improve access for farm workers in the state of Idaho when it comes to care.
Javier, are you there?
Yes, sorry, I was on mute. So good afternoon, everybody. My name is Javier Valdez. I'm the Deputy Director of Lake Road, New York. We are a membership organization that works in three boroughs in the city, in Staten Island, Brooklyn, and Queens. We have about 5,000 members. So one of the things that we work on, in particular, we were very interested in doing work around health issues, was that we thought that it was very important for us to get involved in addressing housing issues. So we currently, in our Bushwick office, in the Bushwick community that we live in, we saw that a lot of members were having issues with housing conditions that was affecting their health. Bushwick has one of the highest rates of asthma in all of the city, and it really affected the young members and youth, and it's the leading cause for people not going to school. So what we started seeing is that in order we had to be able to address this in a very holistic way and see what was causing a lot of the health issues with our members. And what we found out, and it was very interesting to us, was that a lot of our members were living in very bad housing conditions that was triggering a lot of their health issues. So we started a campaign to pass legislation that would make sure that the landlords will make the necessary repairs in the home to fix these housing conditions. And we call this the Healthy Homes Act. So the Healthy Homes Act, we started doing work on this in 2004, and we started to build awareness not only among our members, but we started reaching out and building coalition with other low-income communities in the city where this is an issue as well. With that, we started doing some research, and we found out that a lot of times in New York City, the housing agency sets violations, meaning that they put that there are violations in the housing units, but most of the time they don't get repaired for a year. So a lot of people knew the problem, knew that the city had come in and said that there was a problem, but the landlord was not fixing that issue. So we decided to, we worked with some lawyers, and we decided to create and introduce a piece of legislation that we also call the Healthy Homes Act. The legislation, what we wanted to do was to ensure that if the landlord was not fixing the issues that was triggering unhealthy conditions in the home, that the city will come in after 30 days, do the repairs, and then build a landlord for that. What we kind of decided to do was that in 2005, there was a mayoral and city council election, so we wanted to make this a principal issue in the campaign in particular in the city council campaign. So we pushed really hard. We made this, we went very public. We held different actions and protests outside of people's homes that were living in very bad conditions to bring awareness about the issue. And then try to make sure that we kind of expanded, and we did some research on some of the worst landlords in the city. And we what we found out is that some of the worst landlords in the city, we created a list of the top 10 worst landlords, was that they were financing some of the campaigns for some of the city council members. And we used this as leverage in trying to get them to not take money from them. And if they did, for them to be aware that some of these landlords were making tenants live in very bad conditions. We moved forward. The elections happened. This became a key issue in the election of the Speaker of the Council. We had a forum where all the candidates for the Speaker of the Council were there. This issue was presented, and we did not get a commitment from the person that got elected as Speaker, but she saw the large amount of people that were mobilizing around this. And then for the next year, we just continued to push via press conference. And then at one moment, the Speaker decided to sit down with us, and we were able to pass a legislation in 2007 that would do just what we said, that it would it identified the 400 worst buildings in the city. The city would then go in there and then start making the necessary repairs to ensure that people live in healthy homes. Through this program, what we found is that it has been very successful in those buildings and has been able to reduce a lot of the asthma triggers such as mold and vermin, et cetera, but it's still very, the amount of buildings is very small. So right now we're in the process to see how we can increase the number of buildings that are going through the program, and that just becomes a budget issue, and during this fiscal downturn it gets a little bit harder. So I think it was very interesting. It was an issue that came from our members. A lot of them were complaining about these conditions. A lot of them were coming here with health issues, and we decided to tackle it in a broader perspective and not just make it about a housing issue, but just everybody should be able to live in a place that is healthy and safe for their families. And with that framing, and with using the electoral process as a vehicle to highlight the issue, and then with strong follow-through with actions and lobbying, we were able to pass this legislation.
Thanks, Javier. Jonathan?
Hi, everyone. I'm Jonathan Heller, and I work at Human Impact Partners. Thanks for calling in, and special thanks to NIFCO and to ARC for organizing the call. I'm going to focus on what leads to health and health issues and health inequities outside the healthcare system. So, and the reason for that is about 15% of one's health status is determined by access to healthcare. Another 15% or so is determined by genetics, and that leaves about 70% of health status. So that other 70% is really composed of three main things. One is personal behaviors that I'll come back to in a minute. Second is living and working conditions that we've already just heard something about. Another example of that is that where you live, your zip code really predicts your lifespan. And third thing in that 70% is economic and social opportunities. Again, things like income predict lifespan. While public health is mostly focused on personal behaviors for the last 50 years, there's now an increasing recognition that living and working conditions and economic and social opportunities really mostly determine what personal behaviors one has to choose from, and therefore those are the real root causes of disease, these social determinants of health that Jill mentioned. So because of this, it's extremely important that we understand how living and working conditions and economic and social opportunities influence health outcomes and health disparities. And that means really improving what are thought of as our non-health laws and policies and institutions and structures so that they don't lead to the poor health outcomes and to the disparities. And for us at Human Impact Partners, it means that we're trying to increase the consideration of health in decision-making broadly. We want to change decision-making so that it relies on more than just a faulty analysis of economic outcomes. So to do this, we look at proposed policies, programs, and projects and evaluate the health impacts of those proposals. We use a set of tools called Health Impact Assessment, or HIA. And HIA is a process that aims to make social decisions accountable for their effects on health. It's a combination of procedures and methods and tools by which a policy or project can be judged for its health impact on a population and the distribution of those effects within the population. And that last phrase, this distribution effects within the population, means that we look at impacted population through various lenses, including race, gender, income, age, and we do these health impact assessments with community-based partners. I'm going to give you two quick examples of health impact assessments that we've worked on. So first, last year, we worked on a policy that would ensure that all workers in California have the right to paid sick days. This is really being argued as a labor policy, but it really has, it's really a health policy. It has health consequences. For example, paid sick days would allow workers to stay home and recover themselves when they're ill or take care of loved ones that are sick. It also allows allows workers to avoid losing vital wages when they're sick, so they're not having to choose between working and eating at the end of the month or paying rent, which, again, have health outcomes. And it also allows workers to stay home and avoid spreading infectious disease, such as stomach flu or flu. The health impact assessment we did showed, and the summary of that's on ARC's website for the call, analyzed health outcomes and showed that while about 40% of the population in California doesn't have paid sick days, 73% of Hispanics do not. 70% of restaurant workers don't have paid sick days, despite laws that prevent some of them from coming to work when they're sick, and despite the fact that most stomach flu is really spread through restaurants. So giving paid sick days to restaurant workers, many of whom are Hispanic, would improve their health and the health of their loved ones and the health of the general population. And the groups involved in this campaign used that frame, this health frame, to change the dialogue around the policy and to advocate for paid sick days policies at the state level. A second quick example, very different, is a health impact assessment that we're starting on the proposed expansion of the 710 freeway, which is the major highway that leads to and from the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. It goes through many low-income communities, many communities of color, and those communities are already burdened with high levels of disease, including high levels of asthma. By making the impacts of the proposed expansion explicit, the impacts on air quality, on noise, on the pedestrian environment, on social cohesion, on livelihood and jobs, all of those lead to increases in, you know, problems in those would lead to increases in asthma and heart disease and obesity and stress. By making those explicit, we want to not only change the project, the 710 freeway expansion, but also change the behavior of the institutions that are making those decisions to make them accountable for those health issues. And we're working with a lot of community groups that live around the 710 corridor, plus public health departments, plus the US EPA, NRDC, the American Lung Association, and a bunch of other groups to do that. There are a lot of other ways health impact assessments can be used. For example, Jill mentioned the stimulus money. It could play a role in deciding what projects to fund with stimulus money, and it can impact policies in transportation and housing, agriculture, things we just heard about, education, labor, immigration, and in many other areas. A few specific things you can do moving forward. We're starting an effort at Human Impact Partners to ask the Obama administration to move forward with HIA-related policies that he proposed when he was in the Senate. This is the Healthy Places Act of 2006. If you'd be interested in signing on to a campaign and doing other work around it, it would be great if you could contact me. Second, specific policies outside of healthcare reform are really important for health, and like paid sick days, and I'd urge all of you to support local and national paid sick days campaigns that are going on now and other policies that really are health policies. And third, if you're interested in learning more about health impact assessment, feel free to follow up with us. We conduct trainings and mentor groups and help groups start and conduct health impact assessments. And our website is www.humanimpact.org. That's www.humanimpact.org. So to summarize, I think three main points. Health and health disparities are determined by much more than healthcare. Health impact assessment is a tool that can be used and has been used with impacted communities to improve the health outcomes and to reduce the health inequities associated with these public policy decisions. And third, HIA, I think, is a great tool to both analyze and communicate information about racial inequities in health. And I think that those kinds of health messages really will be an effective way to improve policy and projects that impact health and health inequities. That's it. So thanks.
Thank you, Jonathan, and thanks again to all of our speakers. I just want to say a word about, if you have any questions, now's the time. Email them to compact@arc.org. I do have a few, so I'm going to start with the questions I have, and we'll just continue going on here for a few minutes until we run out of time. So the first question is from, and I'm going to, this one wasn't directed to any speaker in particular, so if you have thoughts, feel free to chime in. So this is from Viviana Ranella from Tigra. She asks, what can individuals do to ensure that racial disparity issues get addressed in healthcare in your state, particularly as it affects immigrant communities? Any of our speakers have thoughts on that? Do we lose our folks? Hello? Leo, Fatima, do you guys have any suggestions?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, it's the question is, what can individuals do to ensure, essentially, how do we make sure that the needs of immigrant communities are being addressed in healthcare in your state, healthcare reform in your state?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll speak to the work that we've done here at Washington CAN, linking up with immigrant rights groups and really working with different groups that work with diverse communities, not just immigrant groups, but communities of color. A lot of the work that we've done here at Washington CAN, finding out about language barriers, the fact that it's not covered for everyone, even though, you know, there's federal laws that say that this needs to be, that services need to be provided for limited English speakers, that all came from the ground up. And so we found about it through word of mouth, through our membership, through our work with allies, group, immigrant rights groups like One America. So really it comes out of the grassroots, but then you can't just hearing about it isn't enough, right? And working with people to address the problems that they're facing in their individual situation doesn't address the needs of everyone, right? And so a lot of our work has been about doing education and connecting the dots both within our membership and our staff, bringing racial health equity work to the forefront, bringing the racial lens, or framing everything with a racial lens, has really been a push for us, and it's somewhere where we're growing and we're still figuring out how to do this work, building broad coalitions, which include people you wouldn't really think of. This working group, we had a lot of service, like social service organizations, but the truth is that's where you hear about it. That's where we found the link and the kind of like the gateway to all the stories. So one is working with communities, getting out there and talking to people, but also taking action, you know, policy, working to affect policy, not just, you know, working with individuals about their situation. So I hope that gives some insight.
Yeah, and I'll say on that note, just kind of a discrete thing that folks can do, depending on your state. So because SCHIP was just reauthorized in Congress, there's an opportunity, if you live in a state that doesn't currently cover legal immigrant kids, there's a real opportunity to work within your state to get those kids covered by CHIP, because now the state doesn't have to, you know, they're not going to be paying for it out of their pocket. It's going to be, it's now a part of the federal program. So that's a real opportunity, again, depending on your state, to get more coverage for immigrant folks in your communities. I have another question here from, I'm going to try and pronounce this properly, Deka Saeed with the International Rescue Committee in San Diego, California. And the question is for Javier. Based on the Healthy Homes Act and the fact that the city comes in and fixes the problem, then bills the landlord, is there any provision that would prevent the landlords from passing that expense on to the tenants as an increased rent?
Thanks for the question. So it depends. The housing laws here in New York are a little bit complicated. So majority of the buildings where they would actually come in and make the repairs, they're what we call rent-stabilized units. If they're rent-stabilized units, their rent can only go up a certain percentage that our Rent Guidelines Board decides on a yearly basis. The landlord can only increase the rent for repairs that are made if they're considered major capital improvements, and that has to get a state approval. So actually, the majority of the time, the tenant will not see an increase in their rent when these types of repairs are made. Broader repairs such as changing the boiler or redoing the roof, et cetera, the tenant will get will see an increase.
And just a reminder, if you have a question, please feel free to email it in to compact@arc.org. I have another question that I'm going to ask, although I'm going to say I'm not sure if folks on the call if this is their area of expertise, but I'm going to put it out there. So the question is from Jessica Roussel. She's with Hip Hop Mental Health Project. And the question is, I'm interested to hear from any of the speakers about barriers to mental health treatment and care for people of color and any successful advocacy that's happening to transform these barriers. Anyone?
Hello?
Sorry, I'm not an expert on that.
Hello? Well, I'll just say this. One thing I know in some of the national efforts that are happening, you know, folks are really paying attention to what the benefit package includes, and that's certainly not a full answer to your question, but I do think that ensuring that in national healthcare reform that making sure that mental health is treated like physical health is pretty important. And again, I know that coverage isn't everything, but that's one thing that I do know is happening. So,
Jill, this is Fatima with Washington Can. I this was before my time here at Washington Can, but I do know that last year, potentially the year before, we worked in coalition with a few other organizations to pass a mental health parity bill. Again, I can't speak to this, but if people want to contact me or email me at fatima@washingtoncan.org, I can get more information. And it was speaking it was dealing with this issue, which is where does mental health play a role in the larger healthcare debate? So I don't have the particulars, but I can definitely link you up with someone who worked on that campaign and can hopefully give you more information.
Thanks, Fatima.
Mm-hmm.
This is Jonathan. The other thing I'd like to throw out is, again, the mental health issues are also often caused by the social determinants of health that Jill mentioned at the beginning. Not having a job leads to mental health issues, and so we need to focus on treatment clearly, but I think we also need to focus on root causes and get back to trying to fix the problems that lead to these mental health problems.
And Jonathan, there's actually a question for you here from Daisy Hernandez at Colorline Magazine. Her question is, do you have a set of health standards by which you assess each project, or does it vary from one to another? And are any other groups using health impact assessments?
So we have a set of what we call indicator standards that we use pretty frequently for work on land use and transportation type projects. And there's a great tool that the San Francisco Department of Public Health put together that includes a lot of those indicators, and it's called the Healthy Measurement Development Tool. And the website for that is www.thehdmt.org, thehdmt.org. And it's got a list of about 120 indicators that are fantastic for land use and transportation work. On the other types of policies like paid sick days, we haven't done enough work on those to have a standard set of indicators, but we would love to work towards those. In terms of other groups doing health impact assessment, there are a few starting to pop out. I think we're the only nonprofit. We're trying to encourage public health departments to do this, and we're trying to engage with community groups to work with them to teach them how to do it and how to get their health departments engaged. And but there aren't a lot yet. It's the field is now just growing in the states.
So I think this is going to may have to be the last question. We're getting near to the end on time. This question is from Allison Gutu. She's with the Equal Justice Works. I'm sorry. She's with the National Advocates for Pregnant Women. And her questions are, well, she has several. I'm going to ask a couple. One is, are all of the speakers' organizations supportive of national health insurance? And if so, are folks supporting H.R. 676, which is the National Health Insurance Act. Silence.
This is Leo. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
I've been playing with my mute button all day here. Sorry. I just on our statement, I actually I'm not one of the healthcare workers. I do more of the size and immigration work. But what we firmly believe is that there needs to be a radical change in where the country is headed right now, and that there needs to be a strong role to the solution. And that's kind of where we stand with regards to healthcare.
Did anyone else want to speak to the question about national health insurance or single payer insurance and support for HR 676?
So at Make the Road, we're working to create a stronger principle of what we support, but the main thing for us is to ensure that everybody does have access to health care. And particularly, we want to make sure that undocumented immigrants are not excluded from any proposal that's going to be presented. And I think that's going to be a big fight, but I feel like that's a key component of any plan that's going to be discussed nationally, inclusion of everybody that's actually here in the United States.
This is Fatima with Washington Can. I echo what Leo and Javier have said, which is that we support we base our support for different bills or laws based on our values as an organization, which means that everyone's included. What shape a bill takes or how those values are embodied by a piece of legislation, that's where we then decide, do we support this or not? Does it meet the needs of our communities? Does it address the issues we're working to address and barriers that we're trying to eliminate? And so that's our piece.
Thanks. So I haven't gotten any other questions here recently. I apologize if I missed anyone's question again. But I want to say we're getting near the end of our time, and there are a few things that I wanted to ask folks to do immediately following this call. So first, I want to ask you all to go check out the ARC website. So it's just arc.org, and a lot of organizations are signing on to what's called their Compact for Racial Justice. It's on their website. You should check it out and consider signing on. It's a way for folks to come together and really sign on to an agenda for fairness and unity and racial justice, and really talks about proactive solutions. So I encourage everyone to go check that out. The other thing I want to do is just say again, stimulus has passed, but implementation is just beginning, and I'm not sure how it's being done in everyone's state. I know, for example, in Idaho where I live, there's an advisory committee, and there's kind of a structure that the governor has created to vet programs for the money. So I encourage folks to figure out in your community how it's going to work and really be involved in that process, because this is one place where I feel like people can really have an opportunity to, inform who's doing the projects, where are the jobs going, how is that money being spent to address disparities. And, as Jonathan was saying, the health impact assessment might be a way to do that. And, again, his website is, Jonathan, it's humanimpact.org?
That's right.
Okay. And then also thehdmt.org is a sample sort of list of standards that folks could look at to kind of get a starting point. I also want to say, there are campaigns right now that are moving nationally. One of the big ones is Healthcare for America Now. Our organization, NIFCO, is very involved in this campaign. They have a set of principles that Fatima was addressing, alluded to, that they're going to vet their policy, the policies that they support by this set of principles, and one of them is around addressing racial justice in health, and then they do also have a separate principle on immigrant inclusion, and these are things that we find are going to be critically important when we look at healthcare reform and making sure that communities of color are end up better at the end of reform, and don't just end up with an insurance card that is you know, in some ways useless and doesn't get them what they need to really have true access and quality care. So, and on that note, I mean, I haven't received any other questions, so I just want to thank again our presenters, Fatima with Washington Can, Leo from ICANN, Javier with Make the Road New York, and Jonathan with Human Impact Partners, and I want to thank ARC for sponsoring this series of phone calls and all of you all for getting on and participating. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
everybody.
Thank you.